Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Sally Bingham. She's a writer and a poet, and her new book of poems is called If in Darkness. She will be reading on Monday, June 21st, in an event sponsored by Garcia Street Books from 5:30 to 7. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you back on the show. Why don't we do this? Let's start with a poem, and then talk, and then hear some more poems.
Good. I'm going to start, I'll read two poems that are written specifically about my mother. The collection is to my mother, not for my mother. It's a subtle distinction. So I'll start by reading a poem called Oil Lamp. In the mountains of West Virginia, 80 years ago, my mother learned to polish each glass chimney, trim each wide wick, so the flames at dusk burn steady and clear. She learned in the same way, at the same time, to polish her verbs, her nouns. She has left me her conviction. Each glass must be cleaned, each tiny flame tended. Wisdom comes in the practice.
Sally Bingham. So when you were writing this book, were you thinking about, I'm going to do a book with my mother in mind, or do these come from a period of years?
They come from quite a few years. I hesitate to say how many. And when I was making the selection, I realized that some of the poems that I felt were the strongest somehow involved my mother. Like many of us, my relationship with her was, shall we say, complicated. And now that she's been dead for 10 years, I find that the complications have finally begun to clear, and I remember her not just as my mother, but as this rather fascinating woman born in 1907 in Richmond and very much a product of her time. And she gave me my words, my love of words, so that is what a lot of these poems are about, is the way she passed on to me her love of words. I'm very grateful for that. I think in the end I was very fortunate to have her as a mother.
It's very interesting what happens when we lose a parent, because we can mythologize them, but we can also kind of work out things in how we felt about them that weren't worked out at the time, but then they're not there to give the feedback.
Exactly, which may be a mercy, because the feedback might destroy the myth. Actually, I think the myth is something I've never really embraced. I've always seen the harsher reality, or what I thought was the reality. So for me, it was coming to terms with something that was pretty harsh, pretty hard to live with as a child. And so it was not so much softening the edges, but really seeing the beauty and the drama of that harshness, sort of like one of our cliffs here in New Mexico, when you first look at it, it looks incredibly barren and forbidding, but after a while you begin to see its beauty.
That sounds like a poem.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? I started out in life writing poetry, what I call poetry. Actually, before I could write, I would dictate these poems to my mother when I got up from my nap, and she would write them down, and I realized later she was correcting them and, as she would say, improving them. So I never know how much of my early poems was really mine and how much was her. She was a very pious woman, so the first poem that I wrote, according to her, maybe so, went, God will, God will not, bless the lamb that he has got. Well, who knows?
So some of these early works survive?
Yes, I copied them all when I could write into a red leather book that my father had sent me. He was stationed in England during World War II. I didn't see him for about 3 years. And he sent this beautiful red leather book with my name in it in gold. And I was so excited and overwhelmed by the thought that this book was for me to write my poems in. So I did. I had to use a ruler and make pencil lines to be sure that the lines would be straight, and then try to erase the pencil line. And in the end, it all went to him in London and came back with him when he finally came home.
We're talking to Sally Bingham. Would you like to read another poem?
Yes, indeed. My mother, like many women of her generation, never threw a button away. And so she ended up with a button box. And the box was those strange old padded boxes that women kept stockings in the days when there were stockings. So this poem is called Button Box. Buttons from brothers' rompers, flat rounds that fastened tops to bottoms, tiny eyes black as seeds off waistbands of Sunday suits, orange snail-shaped silk, placket of Japanese kimono, pretty spoils, white silk-covered dots, 30 fastened my wedding dress, done once, undone once. I don't love him anymore. Round red button popped off a gingham pinafore. This pearl's from the christening gown, each baby's name sewn under a layer. This velvet mushroom's from our first funeral. Picked up, stored away, these buttons should have stopped the future from coming undone.
Sally Bingham, from her new book of poetry, If in Darkness. It is striking how objects of clothing and buttons and things like that evoke so many memories.
Oh, yes. I remember writing about my mother's clothes. The first thing I wrote about after she died was the clothes that she had kept for many, many years in her closet. And each one, for me, had a particular memory associated with it. I remember a green suit she had that she'd gotten in Paris, her first Paris costume. And I always thought it was just the most beautiful suit I'd ever seen, and green is still my favorite color.
So the poems, for people who read them, will tell us one story about your mother, but tell us now in just regular prose, what was she like? What are your earliest memories of her?
She was a very interesting woman. Her name was Mary Caperton, her birth name. As I said, she was born in Richmond, Virginia, at a time 2 decades before women could vote, about 6 decades before the Civil Rights Movement. So she was a woman really of the 19th century as much as of the 20th century. She was one of 6 sisters. She did not like that. In fact, she said there were too many girls.
She wanted to be the one.
Yeah, she wanted to be the one. And they didn't have any money. And when she decided she wanted to go to college, none of this family went to college, she realized she'd have to move out of the house to find time and a mentor and really prepare to take her college entrance exam. So she moved out of her mother's house and went to live with an older woman who had actually been her drama teacher. And when people would ask her, well, why did you leave home, which was considered fairly scandalous in 1924, she said there was never anything in the icebox but flowers, which were all the corsages her very popular sisters were receiving.
Oh, my goodness.
And since there wasn't much money, I guess maybe there was nothing in the icebox but flowers. So she went on to earn a scholarship to Radcliffe and went in 1924, was a Latin and Greek major, again, an anomaly for a woman at that time, and did very well in college, would have done better if she hadn't met the man who became my father. He provided some distraction. And then she also won a fellowship that had only once before been given to a woman, called the Charles Eliot Norton Fellowship in Classical Studies, and went to Athens and spent a year after she graduated from college at the American University in Athens. So all this paints the picture of a highly intellectual, highly disciplined and ambitious woman, which she was. Then she went on to marry and have 5 children, and as everyone knows, this puts a dent in ambition, and I feel she never was really able to pursue her lifelong love, which was classical studies. Instead, she forcibly shaped her 5 children, some of them more resistant to it than others, and had a big role to play in her husband's newspaper in Kentucky and in Democratic politics. So she's a very complicated woman, and as I said, it's taken me many years really to appreciate her. A very driving woman whose ambitions have been frustrated tend to be to drive their children awfully hard.
How did that affect you? I mean, did she drive you to go to college and be a career woman and things like that?
Certainly to go to college. The issue of being a career woman in the 1950s was a perplexed one. First of all, there weren't very many women at that time in the professions. So she certainly was determined that I would go to college and that I would go to her college, which was Radcliffe, since been devoured by Harvard. But in those days, it was a separate women's college. And she also felt that I should be serious. Now, I, too, was married early, had children pretty early, and my ambitions, too, suffered some denting. And I don't know how she really dealt with that. I think in one way she was sort of disappointed that after my first three books, there was about a 15-year period when I didn't publish anything. But I think she also really wasn't willing to see her children make sacrifices that she hadn't made, such as not to marry, not to have children, or to deal with marriage and children in such a way that the career really took priority. I never talked to her about it. I remember when my first son was born and she came to visit, and I was doing something with the baby, and she said to me very sharply, "How can people say that this is all there is?" And it startled me, and I didn't follow up by saying, "Now, what do you mean by that exactly?" But it was pretty clear to me what she meant, that having and raising children could not be the only thing, as far as she was concerned. Now, how you manage, you know, if you don't have help and don't, there's no child care, as we know in this country, and you have children, and you may even be a single mother, as I was for years, how you manage to do anything else, she never really dealt with. She had money and help and could afford to travel and write speeches and edit a book page and so on. But that's not true for the large majority of women in this country, and it was something she never really faced or talked about as far as I know.
Yeah, as we talked about actually on this program just yesterday, the many challenges that mothers have and not having flexible time and proper health insurance,
exactly,
and health care and all that. We're talking to Sally Bingham. Well, let's hear another poem.
All right. Now, this one is a reflection on my childhood. I grew up, as I was saying, in Kentucky in the era when we lived without having much thought about it in segregation. I never met anyone who had a dark skin until I was about 17 or 18, and I remember when it did happen, I was sort of startled. I didn't know how to deal with it. So this is a poem about those days called Two Girls. Perhaps we would never have known what to say to each other had we met when we haunted the woods together. You crossing from the house your grandmother cleaned, I crossing from the house my grandmother owned. We knew the rank smell of green walnuts, tender enough to split with a thumbnail. We knew that stain. We saw the wrinkled bark of the shagbark hickory sag like the skin under our grandmother's chins. Women we loved who taught us hard lessons. "When will you show me that house?" you asked your grandmother, and she promised to take you one day. You liked the tall feather duster she held high over her head as stately she moved through the dark rooms. On the other side of the woods, my grandmother sewed lace like frost on my first party dresses, saying, "Men will take your magic every drop." I did not know I had it, but I did not want it taken. Later, I ran away from her stories, true every one of them, and broke through honeysuckle into the deep valley you were threading from the other side. We did not meet on the bridge over the creek. We did not meet in the abandoned cabin that smelled of men and dogs and whiskey, or on the trail beneath the cliff where the bloodroot grows and the jack in the pulpit lifts its fearsome hood. In our grandmother's fears, we found each other. Darling girls, woods runners, who would come at last to the same clump of trees.
Sally Bingham. So here we are in Santa Fe, a place where there are probably more poets per square mile than most other places.
Yes.
What's it like? What's the community like?
I think there's an amazing community here for writers, but maybe even specifically for poets. I'm feeling really excited because I spent part of the weekend at the Santa Fe Writers Conference.
Right.
Which Ellen Bradbury Reed organized, and I have found it both of the times I've been, last year and this year, really exciting, even, I could say, inspiring. And what I loved about it was we talked a lot about the new technology.
Yeah.
Many of the people who came are either self-published or thinking about self-publishing. So I was able to give a rabble-rousing speech about the drawbacks of self-publishing.
The drawbacks, because you've done quite a bit of it?
No, I've done none of it. I wouldn't dream of doing it.
Ah.
I think it bilks writers. They get in very deep financially without really knowing what's going to be involved. Often the books are unedited, which is a disaster. Often there's no distribution, which is another disaster. So having paid a fair amount of money, a poet ends up with a big box of books in the garage, and unless she's able to sell them to her friends, they may stay in the garage. So I was the voice in the wilderness, or at least one of two voices in the wilderness, saying, beware of self-publishing. But what made it so interesting was that then I learned a lot of very interesting and more positive facts about self-publishing that I didn't know. Such as the fact that some of these outfits do offer an editor. You have to pay extra, but they do offer an editor. Some of them do undertake distribution of some kind or another. But I still think it's worth remembering that by and large, bookstores won't carry self-published books. By and large, they're not reviewed. And that really curtails the audience that you're going to have available to you. But it's always exciting to hear new information and new ideas and a new group of writers that's being drawn into the writing trade, especially with poetry, because it's so very hard to find a publisher for poetry. My publisher for If in Darkness is a small West Coast publisher called T-Boat Bach, T-E-B-O-T-B-A-C-H, which means little teapot in Welsh. The publisher's background is
teapot.
Welsh. So I'm really lucky to have this, but of course it's a very limited number of books. I think they're beautifully produced and well edited. Although I have to admit that I sent a very clean copy to T-Boat Bach. I wouldn't have dared to send something that would have required heavy editing. But, you know, if I sell 1,000 copies, I'll feel myself very lucky, which means I, of course, will make very little money on it, and T-Boat Bach will make very little money on it.
But what book of poetry sells
none.
Big numbers?
Yeah. No. I mean, even the Poet Laureate, the U.S. Poet Laureate, I don't know if those books even make a lot of money. Speaking of which, on Tuesday, we announced the new Poet Laureate, the third for Santa Fe, Joan Logie.
Yes.
And I'm very excited about that. She's, I think, absolutely perfect for this job. She'll serve for 2 years. Do some readings and I think 4 workshops, and knowing how much time she spent teaching, particularly children, I think this is going to be a great boon and advantage for people in Santa Fe who can go to her reading and to her workshops. I'm really so delighted to hear about that. It's a program of the Santa Fe Arts Commission, and I think it's valuable and unique. I don't know how many other cities in this country have poet laureates, but I think it really is unique. There's also, for poets, the wonderful advantage of living in a beautiful landscape.
Yeah.
I write a lot of what would have to be called nature poems, and to be here and every day to see the mountains is really inspiring for a poet. I think there's a reason why so many of the Romantic era poets wrote about landscape and loved landscape, particularly in England. So we're particularly blessed with that here. And I think it gives us a genuine advantage in terms of the material we can turn to. Another thing that I think poetry is just excellent for, and this doesn't particularly apply to Santa Fe, is it's a way to heal a lot of ruptures that people have felt either with their families, with themselves, with their past, and in a slightly more oblique way than the many memoirs that we have seen pouring out in the last two decades. Don't have to be quite as specific about either what happened or how you recovered from it. There's just a more general feeling that the use of words can be healing. And that, I think, has become very important, particularly in maybe the last 15, 20 years. It's a great time for poetry. It's a great time for poets, understanding that you can't make a living.
Right.
But then that's true for most writers. I think the most I made in any year was about $2,500. So it's not going to sustain you economically, which, of course, is a hideous drawback, but it does have the curious positive side effect of removing you from just trying to make money. It wouldn't work in any event, and there isn't any money there to be had.
Sally Bingham, would you like to read one more poem?
Yes, I'd love to. That would be great. This is the one that I wrote, I think the first one that I wrote for my mother, or to my mother. It's called If in Darkness. It's the title poem. And it connects with what I was saying about poetry being used for healing. If in darkness. If in darkness you conceived me, mother, in daylight's broad you taught me all I need. It is the same, the child's forcing and her ecstasy. I do not wish this, but my wishes drift like clouds. From your hand, my body received its necessary learning. Thighs moved and belly trembled, hip bones slung pleasure between them. Your hand, mother, granting me pain, set its flame in the small dark place you too hold between your thighs. Preserved, you missed the gift you gave. Its edges never sliced. You could not know the grace of my body's despair.
Sally Bingham is a writer and poet, and her new book of poems is called If in Darkness. Once again, she will be reading on Monday, the 21st of June, in an event sponsored by Garcia Street Books. It's at 5:30 to 7 in the evening, and the address is not going to be at the bookstore. It's going to be at 519 Camino del Monte Sol. Sally, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome Frank Regano and Paul Marcus. They are co-producers, along with Mariana Amster, of a great big exhibition called Currents 2010 at El Museo Cultural here in Santa Fe. It's video installations and screenings and performances opening today, Thursday, the 17th of June at 5 o'clock. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
So this is a gigantic, sprawling, fascinating group of video artists, some from Santa Fe, some from all over the rest of the world.
Right, yeah. It's a total of 51 artists. There's 19 installations, and how many does that leave? 19? 51?
30-some-odd.
30-some-odd. 32 right. Single-channel artists. And, yeah, we have people, a lot of local people, probably close to 10 local artists. Regional artists, we got people coming from Texas, and then from all over the U.S., Detroit, Seattle, New Orleans.
And then, of course, some young people.
And some young people. We're doing a, we have four for the single channel work, and by single channel I just mean, you know, versus installation.
They're programs, they're like little theaterettes with whole video short programs, so you can sit for a while and watch.
They're almost like these booths.
Exactly.
Yes, they're little. Like, there's four little booths. Each show is approximately a half an hour, and maybe there's eight artists in each little booth. And then we have three of adult, you know, or more mature work. I don't mean by X-rated. I mean more,
right.
You know, adult work. And then we have one booth devoted to teens from local high schools.
Describe to us some of the great variety of work. In other words, there's both thematic and technical variety. I mean, I was in there the other day and saw these tiny little iPods and then projections of related images on a gigantic screen in front of it. Tell us, just give us a picture.
Yeah, like that piece is by Susanna Carlisle and Bruce Hamilton. And they've got two projections and two screens with two projections. And in front of those are tiny iPods with other images, videos on the iPods, inside of Petri dishes that are suspended in front of the other images. So you not only see those images, but you get the refraction of the light onto the video screens too. It's very beautiful. We have that. We have interactive pieces, one by Dr. Woohoo, who is down in Albuquerque. When you first come in, it's a 18-foot-long image that consists of like these digital flowers that as you move, they track your movement and move with you across the screen. From that to actually more narrative work, we have a woman, Heidi, coming from Detroit, who does a beautiful piece about Japanese internment camps. It's very poetic, yet it's really about her parents' or her grandparents' experience in Japanese internment camps.
That's also one of the things I wanted to ask, speaking of that. I mean, mm-hmm. We may have included artists from around the world, but more important, we tried to be inclusive of other cultures. So whether they're Japanese American or African American or Hispanic American, we do have, I don't think we set out to do that, but we got such a broad range of applications and projects that were submitted to us that we were able to happily find high quality and really exciting work that represented different cultures, which is something that, I don't know, really pleases me as well. You know?
What are some of the themes that are being addressed in these culturally diverse works?
There's Wura's piece, which is quite beautiful.
That's
Wura, Wura Natasha Ogunji lives in Texas, and her piece really is relying, I mean, it's a very intense piece, very strong, very beautiful, but it really relies on her African heritage. And it's very hard to explain. I don't even know how to begin explaining it. But you'll see it has this very ritualistic kind of African feel to it. But she's a African-American, you know, but she's relying on that, you know, her heritage to present this work. It's a stunning piece, really, really good, very beautiful.
The kids represent a lot of some of the Hispanic.
Yeah, a lot of we have a tremendous amount of work from Española Valley High.
Yeah, a tremendous amount of work from Española Valley High. What's going on? There's a great teacher, video teacher there.
Ellen Capier, she works with also Jonathan Lowe, who also works with Ellen out at Española Valley High, and the kids love her. She's a great teacher. They love Jonathan, and they love the kids, and they just crank out the work, and it's really wonderful. You know, it's all kinds of work, from very serious to very funny. Just the one piece that's just very musical. These young Mexican kids just videoing themselves in the recording studio, but with the whole piece of music, they're just great musicians, you know. So it's a total range from them. It's just really, really wonderful. And then we also have work not only from Española Valley High. We have it from a couple of pieces that are very strong from Capitol. A couple pieces from Desert Academy that are very, very good.
They've got a great arts program
yeah,
there.
Yeah, Chris Zapp there is one of the video teachers. And he's really training people to be professionals in a way. That's like, seems to me, when you see the quality of this work, it's quite exceptional. And then a piece from Monte del Sol.
And on the 26th, Saturday the 26th, we have a show, kind of a mini opening for that segment of that program of the kids' work. So we're hoping their families and the kids and their friends will come out and you know, see their work on in a featured kind of way.
Yeah, because for the run of the show, their work's going to be on a flat panel in one of the little screening rooms. But on the 26th, we're going to project it. We're going to take it off the flat panel and project it. And just today, I was talking to one of the directors, Aida. I can't remember her last name, but she's one of the directors for the Boys and Girls Clubs. And they're going to be sending groups to come see the show next week and try to get a group to come for the kids' opening. Because one of the things we really want to do is to expose people who may not otherwise have the opportunity to see new video and new digital media work, to expose a broader population to that. And that's also one of the reasons why our shows have always been free. Because if people are a little hesitant about seeing new work, you put a price tag to come in the door.
They're not coming.
They're not coming.
Yeah.
You know? So our goal is really to allow people without having to, spend the money they maybe don't have to come in and really experience new work.
To El Museo, and it's running through the 27th of June. It's free every day from 10 to 7. Now, one of the things that characterizes the time that we are in history right now artistically is that virtually everybody has access to a camera because it's on their phone. Most people have access to video in one way or another. Either it's on their phone or it's on some little relatively inexpensive. I mean, even 20, 30, forget about 40, 50 years ago, people's access to making serious media was limited by how much they could afford to pay for equipment and processing and all of that. That leads to a situation where there's, well, a lot of not so good stuff, but also a lot of talent that you
right.
have to sift through.
Well, you see a lot of what you'll see at our show is not what you might see if you tune into a YouTube marathon where everybody with a video camera or an iPhone can send something into their to their website.
Although there's great stuff on YouTube too.
Indeed,
yeah,
there
but
is.
It's yeah. I'm not putting it down. All I'm saying is it's we were looking for a different style of work, so experimental work, almost more like if you were going to an art gallery, but this is more electronic or video or new media oriented. No, it's not like you can't find something great on YouTube, but we relied on local artists, known and unknown, and also people sending in work that are really cutting edge and trying to break boundaries and do something that I guess is, you might call it gallery worthy, I guess, was that how you put it?
Yeah, but one of the things that we strive for in our shows is we don't want the feeling of a gallery. We really, we almost think of some of the things we do as video circus in a way, where people feel like there's things going on here, there's things going on there, there's things across the room, so people can really come in and enjoy themselves. And it's not taking away from the quality of the work or the seriousness of the work or the lightheartedness of the work, but it's really an environment that people can really also enjoy themselves. At the same time, they can be challenged. They can enjoy themselves.
Well, and El Museo Cultural is the size of an airplane hangar.
Yeah, it's a big room, and it's quite a bit to deal with. This is the biggest thing. We've been putting on shows here as Parallel Studios. The first one we did was at CCA in 2002 in the warehouse before it was renovated, when we had to cover the whole roof with tarps because it was leaking so bad. And that show was a great success, but that was only 5,000 square feet. Now we're in 17,000, so it's a big challenge. But we've done many shows over the years.
So what's Parallel Studios about?
Well, Mariana and I actually founded Parallel Studios in 2002, actually to do this first show at CCA. And since then, we did two shows at Art Santa Fe when they were at the Sweeney Center. Upstairs, we had half of the upstairs. And then we were invited to do that, to do that. And we've done, when Salon Margraff was open, we took over the whole gallery for a month and did video throughout, which was an interesting juxtaposition with that old building and then the new work.
Yeah, that was a wonderful place, yeah.
Yeah, it was a great place. And then last summer we did a show at Zane Bennett. So that's kind of the history of what we've been doing.
So, do you, either of you have a favorite piece or a couple of favorite pieces?
Not yet. I want to see how it all kind of comes together. I've been seeing pieces more of the, especially because the installations are not up and some of them are being put up for either the first or second time. Like Rob Campbell's told me, he said, can't wait to see it because it's.
Yeah.
He's not sure what
that's
it's going
to. That's the one you saw with a cast glass.
Ah, right. So yeah, I went over there a couple of days ago and it was just in process. And I guess it's with things like this, there's so many people and so much work, it's kind of like that until 15 minutes before the opening.
That's right.
Which is today, ladies and gentlemen, at 5 in the evening. It goes till 9 in the evening at El Museo Cultural.
Yeah, what I want to say is one of my favorite things. I don't really have any favorite pieces because I love a lot of them. Because part of the great pleasure of doing this is looking at all this work and just loving it, you know, and being very excited about showing it. But it's also, and this has a lot to do with the internet too, because of the connections that you make through the internet. Because the way we got submissions was by posting this on online sites where video artists know to go to look for shows. Is you start meeting people from all over the world and Skyping with them and talking to them, and it's like the community just expands, you know, and that's actually almost my favorite part.
You know, that's another thing that I think is so important to talk about, because there's a lot that is said and written about the demise of neighborhoods and local communities and things like that, and yeah, that's true, but there are all these other communities that are springing up where people with similar interests can really share on a deep level across Skype and all of these types of cyber
media. And what was surprising was that we find out that there are people out there making this sort of work, and maybe they don't have a place that's local to show it, so they're finding a guy like Frank going like, come on, we'll show it.
Yeah.
And across the world, or remember that that Korean virtual gallery or virtual museum?
Yeah,
that was fascinating. We didn't hook up with them. Yeah, we didn't hook officially, up with them. But maybe we'll do that next year.
Yeah, there's actually was this place on it was on Second Life, and it was called Ars Virtua, and you could go to it was like a museum in Second Life, virtual museum, and you could go there, and there in the outside they had outside virtually. They had this video exhibit going on of Korean artists, like the history of Korean video. And there was incredible stuff.
The history of Korea. Who even knew to think of the phrase, the history of Korean video?
Right, starting with like Nam June Paik.
Right.
And it was just incredible. So we actually made contact with some of the artists that were there. And it was just great.
You can find it all at Currents 2010, starting today from 5 to 9 at El Museo Cultural. Put together by Parallel Studios in Santa Fe. It's free. It's running every day through the 27th of June from 10 in the morning till 7 in the evening. Boy, you're going to be able to go. It's practically never closed.
Yeah, and let me just... one aspect of this that we haven't talked about is the performance aspect.
Yes.
Saturday night, there's going to be two performances. David Stout, who used to be... And Corey Metcalf, who used to both be at the College of Santa Fe. Are now in Denton, Texas. David's at Denton, Texas, at the University of North Texas, I believe it's called. And they're coming into town. Not only do they have a projection that'll be on, a three-channel projection that'll be run throughout the show, but on Saturday night at 6 and at 10, they're going to do a performance, a live performance, where they interact. They are each on a laptop. They're creating images in relationship to each other, and the images also generate sound. It's really quite fascinating. And the reason why it's at those weird times, 6 and 10, is because we're trying to sandwich the Bill T. Jones show. We're trying not, so people can either come before it or come after it if they're going to the Bill T. Jones show.
Excellent.
And then Victoria Garrison is doing a silent performance, a masked performance in relationship to Ann Farrell's video installation. And then also on...
That's on June 17th, 18th, and 19th.
And 19th. It's going to happen at random times, mostly in the evening probably. She'll just appear and start performing.
So today, tomorrow, and Sunday.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean Saturday.
Saturday, yeah. And then also Madeline Coit, who does a... Her video installation is about a shredding machine where she has shred all the documents from her past life, and this not as past, her present life, but from the past. And she's going to do a little narrative dialogue about the shredding. And she invites people, anybody who would like to shred anything about their life to come, she will have shredding machines there and you can shred.
Bring your diaries, ladies and gentlemen.
And that will be Friday and Saturday from 4:30 to 5:30.
Well, thank you both so much for being here, Frank Rugano and Paul Marcus. And if people want more information, they can go to...
Currents2010.com.
So Currents, and then the digits 2010, Currents2010.com.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm very happy now to welcome Christina Selby. She's co-founder and executive director of EarthCare. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary.
So you have recently received a grant from the AmeriCorps program. What's that all about, and what are you doing here in Santa Fe?
Well, the AmeriCorps program, it's a national program. A lot of people relate it to a domestic Peace Corps. And so it engages young people 18 to 25 in jobs, and they get an educational stipend at the end of that program. And their focus is really to do direct service in the community to meet critical community needs, you know, in education, in the environment, in social services. And so EarthCare, about in December, applied for an AmeriCorps grant with a number of partners. And the focus of the work that we'll be doing in Santa Fe is around food security. So it's called the Youth Food Corps Program. And we just were awarded the grant, and we'll have 11 positions for young people. And we're collaborating with the Santa Fe Alliance, Cooking with Kids, Santa Fe Farmers Market, the public schools, the city and the county, and a number of other folks who will receive placements to work on different projects focusing on building a local secure food system for Santa Fe.
What does food security mean? What's a secure food system look like?
Well, food insecurity may be a little more easy to describe. It's when folks don't know where their next meal is coming from. You know, I think New Mexico is 45th in the country in terms of hunger and food insecurity. And in Santa Fe, there's this disparity in wealth, and so there are large pockets of the population that do experience food insecurity, and especially children. There's 21%, I think, of children in Santa Fe live in poverty, and so food security often comes along with that.
So that's food insecurity. You know, there's two different things that it means when you say you don't know where your next meal is coming from. One is you can't afford food. The other is, if I really think about it, I don't know where, like California or Iowa or Texas, my next meal is coming from.
Exactly. And a lot of times people talk about food security, and that they meet the needs of the hungry by bringing in food from other places. And so this program is really to address both the hunger need, but also looking at how we can develop our food system to meet that need locally and really offer local farmers and growers and food entrepreneurs an opportunity in that area to grow the local food system. And so New Mexico and the Santa Fe urban sort of consumer food shed can be more secure. And, you know, we're also looking at the growing threat of climate change and what's that going to do to our food system. So how we can sort of be proactive and really look at what the capacity is to grow food in this area.
So eating locally has become popularized partly through the work of people who are who talk about how important it is to eat food from your area. Is it possible to feed more than a small number of New Mexicans with locally grown food? Have you done the math on that?
Well, I haven't done the math, but I've been doing my own personal experiment for about the last 6 months to try to eat locally, and it is very difficult, especially because I started in February and there wasn't a lot growing in the area. So, you know, cheeses and meats are pretty accessible, but they're more expensive. So this program is designed, in a sense, that's a big challenge that we have to look at and we have to face. And the Food Policy Council is working with us to do a community food assessment and look at where the food can come from. And I've talked with the schools and the food farm to school director there. And a lot of the issues in terms of getting local healthy food into the schools is not about, some of it it's about availability and some of it's about other obstacles, policy, food safety rules, things like that can be transformed to get more food available from the local growers.
How are local farmers doing?
Yeah.
Farmers markets are very popular now. There's a great movement and there's a great growth in farmers markets, but there's also, it's also difficult for farmers to retain their land and not sell it and make enough money to keep going.
That's definitely a challenge. And the other thing that we're looking at is the age of the farming population. You know, I think the average age of the farmers at the farmers market is 57 years old.
Is that right?
And there's fewer and fewer young people because there's less farming families in the United States in general, but there's fewer young people coming up to be farmers. And so we're also looking at this as an opportunity to gauge young people from the age of 5 through school gardens all the way up to 25 in learning about food systems and learning about the importance of farming and in developing some skills through being involved in community gardens and school gardens, which are growing in popularity. So they have that thinking that it could be a viable option
And they have the affection and familiarity with
it. Right, with working with the land. You know, there's a lot of young people who don't want to get their shoes dirty working in the garden, so working through all of those issues. And there's a growing interest in urban young people in farming, maybe because they are so disconnected. You know, it looks like maybe a fun, interesting thing to do. But I think with the growing locavore market, there's a lot of opportunity for farmers to do more and to grow more. But it's not an easy field to be in.
So you have this opportunity from AmeriCorps, and you're looking for young people. What are they going to be doing?
So they'll be placed at these different organizations that I mentioned before, and they'll be working on their food projects. And they'll also be placed in the schools to help grow school gardens, change the school lunch program so they have healthier food. They'll also be working to develop urban agriculture sites, either large demonstration sites. They probably be working with the Santa Fe Community Farm to help them expand their program. Also providing support and resources to community gardeners, home gardeners. They'll be developing a community kitchen in La Cienega through the Santa Fe Alliance, doing food and nutrition education in the schools through Cooking with Kids, and then also peer-to-peer education through an Earth Care program.
We had Cooking with Kids on not too long ago, and one of the things that we learned is that even when you offer kids healthy, nutritious, delicious food, if they're not used to it, sometimes they won't eat it. That's a whole education in itself.
Exactly, yeah. So they do a lot of tasting of food, and so this program will help to expand that program, as well as talk to them about what causes childhood obesity and diabetes and how they can be addressing that themselves as young people.
So are you inviting people to apply for the program?
Yeah, so we will have 11 positions open for 18 to 24-year-olds. We'll be posting those jobs in the next couple weeks here. And they are year-long positions. They're a really great opportunity for people to get into nonprofit work, to understand food systems, to get engaged with growing food and food entrepreneurship. And they do get a living wage and a stipend that supports them through that process. And they'll be involved, all of them will be involved with younger kids as well. So we're really looking at a spectrum of 5 to 25 this program will serve.
And a wonderful opportunity for a recent high school graduate or somebody looking to take a year off from college.
Exactly, or a recent college graduate.
Right.
You know, all of those age groups we'll be looking for.
And are you looking for specifically people who are New Mexico residents?
We would love to hire and recruit locally. You know, there's this phenomenon of brain drain. People or young people leaving Santa Fe and Los Alamos and Taos because they can't find work and afford the living expenses in those communities. So we're really looking at bringing back young people who have gone away to college and maybe are finishing and want to come back to Santa Fe, or recruiting from young people who are still here and are looking for jobs. So that's our goal.
And so this is all Earth Care, which is a nonprofit organization based in Santa Fe. How long have you been around?
We've been around in Santa Fe for 8 years. We've been doing programming and have supported youth-led projects that have focused on food throughout that time.
Well, Christina Selby, Executive Director and Founder of Earth Care, thank you for being with us. If people want to find out more, can you give us the telephone and website?
Yeah, our website is www.earthcare.org, and you can call us at 983-6896.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz presents some artists who will be coming to Santa Fe very soon. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Robert Knott will be here, and we will be speaking about toxic talk, right-wing radio. That's all on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Ciao.